We are continuing this morning our study in Esther and looking at chapter 5. It's 14 verses, and Lord willing, we'll cover the theme of this passage together. The other day, my wife commented on how quickly this series is going because we're basically taking one chapter at a time, and we are at this point halfway through our exposition of this book. I said to her, I have to do it that way or I'm afraid I'll start making stuff up. And what I mean by that is that the way narrative material works, there is not some kind of self-standing theological point in every statement like you might expect in the epistles or something. And understanding comes from considering units of thought, which tend to be pretty long, in this case, typically a whole chapter at a time, works together to get across a big idea. And so it takes a while to process that and to cover that much ground, but we are making good progress, and here we are at chapter 5. If you remember, last week, I called the message the defining moment, which is when Esther, having learned of the great threat against her people, after some struggle about what she should do in her role about the problem, she finally makes a decision that after 3 days of fasting and ultimately seeking the Lord through that fasting, she was going to take a risk, stick her neck out, and do whatever she possibly could to deliver her people from destruction. And so it was a critical chapter, it was a pivotal story, and we come to chapter 5, and there are things happening, but it's still not really the heart of the action. There's still a lot of preparation that is going on here. There's still a lot of setup for the turn of events that comes about in chapter 6. And as I initially thought about this chapter, I actually said, I'm not sure what I'm going to preach from Esther 5, because there are these preparatory events and we don't have a lot of theologically explicit statements about what the point is. You know, how am I going to handle this? But the more that I meditated on it, the more that I read as well some literary analyses that other people have done, it struck me there actually is a lot here that is very practical and that is quite helpful for us as we make our way in this world, trusting the providence of God, how we view events around us, and how we try to figure out what it is we're supposed to do in the plan of God. And I want to talk about that this morning in terms of chess. You see there some chess pieces, and you may be interested in this game. I'm not very good at it myself. But a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I watched a movie that was actually about chess. Now, that sounds kind of boring, but it actually was pretty interesting. It wasn't about chess. It was about a young Ugandan girl who became just an amazing player and had platforms all over the world to be able to display her skill. It's called the Queen of Katwe. And she learned chess through the influence of a Christian ministry that was reaching out to young people in a slum area in Uganda. And this was one of the tools that they used to occupy the kids, to build relationships with them, to help them in some very difficult circumstances of life. And she became, and still is, a world-renowned chess player. And she picked it up so quickly that the coach was shocked how quickly she was beating even the boys who had been in that little ministry for a long time playing chess. And her ability not just to put the pieces in the right places and make good moves, but actually to think 5, 6, 7 steps ahead of time, to anticipate, if I do this, later on I can do this, and if this person moves here, then I already have in mind where I could move to get around them. The strategy that was involved was remarkable, considering her age especially. Well, when we read this chapter, what we're looking at is a strategy type game where certain pieces are being put into certain positions of the chessboard so that when the moment comes for the most important move, everything is ready to go, everything is in place. And that's going to happen in chapter 6. Right now, there is a lot of strategizing going on to get things ready for that pivotal moment. And as we think about that, I'd like to focus on this chapter in terms of divine providence and human participation. Divine providence and human participation. As we see how these chess pieces get into place, we're going to see that the placement is going to happen through a clear and yet a mysterious combination of God working and people working as well. And what we find is that in the first part of the chapter, Esther is the main human actor, and she's getting certain things into place. In the second part of the chapter, Haman is the main human actor, and he thinks he's getting certain things into place. When you back off, and particularly as you see where this all goes eventually, starting in chapter 6, you recognize that there is a mastermind that is behind all of these human decisions and all of these human actions, and that God is the ultimate strategist that somehow, in the mystery of his providence, is getting everything where it needs to be. And so let's look, first of all, at the role of Esther in verses 1 to 8, and I think we could fairly describe her contribution this way: divine providence and human shrewdness. Divine providence and human shrewdness. Let's read these verses. Esther chapter 5, verse 1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters. While the king was sitting on his royal throne, inside the throne room, opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request?" "It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Divine providence and human shrewdness. The first point that we encounter here is actually going to emphasize the providence part in what could seem as just a passing chronological marker when the text begins by noting that this happened on the third day. On the third day of what? What is that referring to, and what does it have to do with all of this? Well, that is a follow-up comment on what she had said at the end of chapter 4. And she said, "We're going to take these days to seek the Lord by fasting." And I did take that as an indication, the fasting, that she was displaying there a new reliance on the Lord, a recognition that this was beyond her, that she needed supernatural help, and so the people needed to humble themselves and probably turn from all of their sins and seek the Lord for him to deliver them out of this crisis. And so when the text of this chapter begins by saying, on the third day, you're being reminded of what's gone on during the last little period of fasting, that this was a statement about their need for God and about their seeking him for his assistance. But you know, we can broaden out the context beyond the story and beyond this book. And the fact is that that expression, on the third day, was well known to the Jewish people for other reasons. In fact, you may remember that I made a comment about that at the end of our study of Luke not too long ago. And what I mean is that that expression of something happening on the third day has a background in the Old Testament where the people of God were in a moment of crisis, or they were facing some kind of a threat. And it talks about how on the third day, the Lord sort of kicked in high gear and began to work on their behalf to deliver them. This was what happened in Genesis 22, when Abraham is called of the Lord to sacrifice his son Isaac, and that event and the ram that God provided so that he would spare his son, it all happened on the third day of that trip. There was another crisis faced by Abraham's descendant Jacob in Genesis 31, where he was running away from Laban. And it's on the third day that Laban catches up with him. And there is that moment of tension as to what's going to happen with these two men who are now so at odds with each other. And God works to create peace and the resolution of that conflict. Then jumping ahead to Jonah chapter 1, on what day was it that he was delivered by that fish? How long did he spend in the belly of that fish, and on what day was it that he got spit out to go now and carry out his mission? The third day was also the day of deliverance. And actually, not too far away from the time frame of Jonah, you have the prophet Hosea coming along, and he is in chapter 6 urging the people of God to repent from their sin, to turn to the Lord, and he assures them on the third day he will deliver us. And it becomes a sort of a formula for speaking about the relatively short periods of time that pretty frequently take place in the lives of God's people. But the point is, just hang on, trust the Lord, do what you need to do in this moment. You're going to find that in a relatively short period of time, the Lord's going to come through on the third day. He's going to work out the deliverance, and you're probably going to be surprised at just how dramatic it is. And this helps explain why in Luke 24, when the Lord is teaching the disciples about his own career, and he says, don't you know that the Old Testament actually had taught you that the Messiah was not only to suffer before he entered in his glory, but he was going to be raised on the third day to enter his glory? Now, the Old Testament never says the Messiah is going to be killed and is going to rise again on the third day. But Jesus seems to be pulling on this concept, this theme in the Old Testament, of 3 days being a relatively short period of waiting on the Lord to deliver. And he says that actually anticipated my own deliverance from death in the resurrection, which is why also earlier he said that Jonah's 3 days in the belly was actually anticipating his own experience of being buried for that period of time in the grave and then rising up. And if, as a sensitive Jewish reader, you keep this theme in mind, and the very first thing you read, opening this chapter, after this woman has said, I'm going to take this risk, what's going to happen? As a little encouragement, just hang on. God's going to work all this out. It's on the third day that things begin to move. And so the chapter begins with that reminder of the providence and the deliverance of God. But that doesn't minimize the fact that Esther didn't really know ahead of time what was going to be the outcome of her efforts there. She really was putting her life on the line. And by approaching the king in general and by asking specifically about the deliverance of her people, she was putting herself in an extremely dangerous position. And I think we would do well to think about that, to appreciate the struggle. As I've noted before, when we know these Bible stories so well, it's a little hard to get into them and kind of relive the moment, because we know that God works it all out, but at the time, they had no idea where this was all going, and she could have lost her head. She really could have. So consider some of the dangers that she was facing. She could have been executed, as anticipated in chapter 4. She could have been executed simply for showing up without having been summoned. That was the level of the control that the emperor had over people, that everything was at his bidding. You didn't take the initiative. You didn't start a conversation with him. You certainly didn't just show up in his court. You were treading on dangerous ground to just show up there uninvited. And if you're remembering what happened in chapter 1, we know that Xerxes is rather sensitive about this question whether people are summoned or not and how they respond, because his other wife got banished from their marriage because she didn't come when she was summoned. So in chapter 1, you have a woman suffering for not showing up when she should have. And in chapter 5, you have a woman showing up when she wasn't supposed to be there. This is risky territory. But you have some other thoughts here that help us understand the difficulty for Esther. She had actually kept her identity hidden from her husband for the last 5 years since they were married. And you kind of wonder what all went on between the two of them that he didn't even know where she was from. It suggests something of the lack of actual marital intimacy between these two, and that she was just there for his pleasure and for his pride and not for an actual relationship. Either that, or she was a really good liar or somehow able to cover up, blending in so much that it wouldn't even cross his mind that she wasn't a Persian woman. And here she's going to show up 5 years into marriage and tell him that she belongs to these oppressed people, these people oppressed by the Persians, their enemies, that they kept under their close control. She's a member of this marginalized group that a lot of people hated at the time, and she had been keeping this from this man. Seemed like a recipe for marital problems, at the least. In addition, consider that what she ultimately was asking him to do was to go back on something that he had stuck his neck out about just a little bit earlier, and he had let Haman talk him into making this decree that according to their law was inviolable and he could not revoke. You realize what an idiot he would look like to have to backpedal and say to everybody, actually, my wife is one of those people. We maybe could try to figure something out here. The awkward position that she is putting him in, the way that this is making him look bad as a leader, when what she's asking is that he somehow find a way to undo his own decision. And then as you look particularly at the wording of verse 1, you get this feeling that this is an intimidating circumstance for her to walk into. Let me read that again. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. See, he's using these words to, the author's using these words to paint a picture of this imposing setting that Esther's walking into at the very heart of the empire, the place where decisions are made, the very throne room of the king. And the author keeps repeating this language of royalty. That's intimidating. And we might get a better picture of it if we understood a little bit more about that setting. What you're looking at next is a picture of the discovered Persian city of Persepolis. You may remember that they had four different capitals. These events took place in Susa. Persepolis is one that we have a lot more information concrete about. And it's something like 31 acres, this massive platform at the foot of some mountains where they constructed all of these buildings that were there to speak of the power of the government and where the government's affairs are going to take place. I want to show you a few more pictures that give you some idea. Here are some of the pillars that would have held up the roof of one of these buildings. And then to the palace proper itself is what you're looking at there. So you can imagine Esther going through some of these kinds of doorways. And to give you a little more idea, I've got here another picture of one of the reliefs that is by artists put up as a little sculpture on the side of, actually on either side of the doorway into the palace. And on that throne in the middle is the Persian emperor. That may actually be Xerxes himself. And you see that he's holding a stick, which is actually the scepter that this chapter talks about. And you see somebody behind him that is holding up something over his head, and you might think, well, that's some slave that is fanning him. Actually, archaeologists think that this represents one of the attendants who was next to the king, and he's actually holding an axe. And the point is that at any moment, even in the court itself, even in the throne room, if somebody gets out of line, Xerxes has at his disposal a weapon and somebody there ready to go to execute whoever he wants off with his head. That is the kind of situation that this woman is walking into. So how would you have felt? It was an extremely risky situation. And yet, there's some other subtleties going on here that begin to highlight the opportunity that was before her and that things are not going to turn out maybe as bleakly as she might have feared. It's no mistake that at verse 2, she is identified specifically as Queen Esther. Just like there is King Xerxes on his royal throne in the palace, she has a title of power as well, and she is identified as being officially in this position. In fact, listen to what one commentator says about the statistics of how Esther is identified. She says, Esther is referred to by name 37 times in the story. In only 14 of those references, she is, quote unquote, Queen Esther. All but one of those 14 references to her as Queen Esther occurs after chapter 5, verse 1, which is where we began this morning. Esther assumes the dignity and power of her royal position only after she claims her identity as a woman of God in chapter 4. So in other words, up to this point, it's basically Esther, Esther, Esther. After this point, it's Queen Esther. This is by design on the part of the author to paint her in this position of influence and as having power herself. And as a reader, you're encouraged. And the dividing line between those two is, as he says, the decision she makes in chapter 4. I'm finally going to come out, and I'm finally going to identify as one of the people of God. So that's encouraging. But then you have some other indications of just remarkable shrewdness, or as I say here, of deftness on the part of Esther. I imagine that during those 3 days, she wasn't just fasting and praying. She was doing a lot of hard thinking. Because when you read the steps that she took, she was not just winging it here. This was a very carefully laid out sequence of actions that evidently she was thinking about in those 3 days to figure out, best she knew how, what approach is likely to be most successful to accomplish the purpose that I have before me. I'm not just going to run in there and blurt this all out. I'm going to approach this, like so many other things in this book, in a sideways approach. I'm going to do it gradually. I'm not going to put all my cards on the table right away. I'm going to be careful to read the situation and know who I'm dealing with and figure out the best approach with some indirectness to it to skillfully manage this situation in my favor best that I can. Now, this woman shows remarkable skill here. Even the fact that she wears her royal robes, evidently she did not always don the official garments of her position as a queen. They would have had, obviously, very expensive and beautiful things to wear all the time, but there's a difference between sort of normal clothing that she would have worn, particularly in her moments of physical intimacy with her husband, which, if you remember back to when she became the queen, she was just always following the orders of the eunuch, you know, what's going to be the best that I can wear and how, what procedure should I go through to make myself most acceptable to the king. At this point, she is taking the initiative, and by her clothing, she is communicating, this is an official transaction of business, and I'm in my official role here. And as you know, sometimes your clothing symbolically sends a message about what you are pursuing or trying to do in a particular situation, and she used that to her advantage. And then even the approach that she takes, did you notice this also in verse 1? That she didn't just walk up into the king's court brazenly, like, I'm here, you've got to listen to me. You realize what she did? She walks toward him. She stands in the inner court in front of where he would have been sitting, within sight of him, and she just stands there. Okay? That is a good move on her part as well. Making herself visible so that he has to notice her and so that he has to respond to the indirect approach that she's taking, but on the other hand, not pushing herself forward. So it's like she's asserting herself enough to be in that situation, but not too much so as not to offend and look like she is taking over or being brazen. That's interesting. And then you might remember that a number of other times in this story, it talks about how she, through her very careful actions, particularly when she was in the process of becoming queen, it doesn't say at that point that she found favor, like she was just kind of passively there and it happened. She acted in such a way that she thought was likely to win her favor. We might say she put her best foot forward or something like that. She was doing all that she could in order to garner positive attention without going too far. And just like happened over there in chapter 2, it happens here as well. She succeeds. She uses her skill to win the favor of the king. As you know, there are a couple of quick ways to a man's heart, and the one we normally think of is through his stomach. And Esther evidently understood that as well. And again, instead of saying, "I got a big problem. Haman's over here trying to kill my people. You've got to do something about it." She says, "Hey, I want to invite you and Haman to a feast, to a banquet. And there's going to be great food and great drink. My invitation." That shows some skill, where she is actually appealing to this man's hedonism. Remember all this about the feast that we've already seen repeated through this book? This guy was a real party animal. And she knows that. And she uses that to her advantage by just laying it out as lavishly as she could and inviting him and Haman to this feast. She knows how stuck on himself Haman is and how privileged he would feel to be invited to this unique banquet that the queen herself is putting on. This is the approach he's going to take to prepare the way for a very difficult request, but she is making it as smooth as possible and working things so that they are as likely as possible to go in her favor. In fact, as she has the banquet is held sort of on her territory, we might say. She is the hostess, and she is preparing everything. It's at her invitation. That position where, in this little scenario, she's the one calling the shots and setting everything out and kind of managing this meal, it also gives her some leverage in the conversation. And as she actually talks to him, to the king, when he, after feasting himself, asks her again, "What is your request?" She says in verse 8, notice how she words it this time. She doesn't say, "If I have one favor." That might have sounded too aggressive. She actually, this time, unlike the other references, says, "If I have found favor." In other words, it's throwing it back on him as if he's the decision maker here. And she's in a passive role when she actually hasn't been passive. And she says, "If I have found favor and if it pleased the king." You find in this chapter the repetition of another set of terms that we saw earlier. Remember I talked about how Xerxes was all about if it pleases me, if it's good to me, or if it's good in my eyes. Remember that terminology? She brings that up again. If I have found favor and if it is good or pleasing to you. In other words, she is putting it all in his lap and appealing to his self-interest and conveying it in a way that she recognizes that he's the one that has to make the decision. And in fact, for him to come to the feast is already indicating that he has to do what she is asking him to do. Look at the verse again. "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, if it pleased the king to grant my wish, fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I'll prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." If, in fact, I have found favor to where you're going to do what I'm asking, come. In other words, by coming, he is essentially obligating himself to do something favorable about the request. She is wording this and presenting it in a way that he has to commit himself ahead of time to whatever it is, and he's going to be shocked to find out what it is, but just like has happened before, he is going to look bad at this point if he doesn't go along. This woman really knows what she's doing. And she is sort of behind the scenes, even though she is the less privileged, the woman in this very patriarchal situation, she is actually the one who's running the show, we would say, practically speaking. And I think there's a point to be made from that as well. Xerxes is the mighty emperor, the one who's built all these buildings, ostensibly the one in charge. And yet a woman has found a way skillfully to get the upper hand in the situation, to box him in a corner, we might say. Which is pretty striking because this whole story began with some tension between husband and wife when a wife wasn't going along with an extreme and unfair request of her husband. And so in response to that, they're all like, we got to get these women under control. And so it's not just about my marriage. We're going to send this message all throughout the world. You ladies have to submit to your husbands. They're the ones in charge. It's like, I'm the one in charge in my marriage. Well, his wife refused his bidding, and she never did go along with it. And now Esther, who ends up his wife now as a result of all that, she is actually indirectly using her position with this skill to get her way. This is just another way, as we've seen a number of times in this passage, that Xerxes, when you look at everything that's happening, he is just a responder. He's the one in charge, but he's really not in charge. More and more, he just comes out as a laughable figure, as an idiot, just being manipulated by everybody around him. Now, including Esther, is able to pull that off. Now, I'm not going to vouch for everything that Esther did. However, I am going to point out some things that Proverbs tells us. Listen to Proverbs 16. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, and a wise man will appease it. Or in this story, we might say a wise woman will appease it. In the light of a king's face, there is life, and his favor is like the clouds that bring the spring rain. And Solomon was a king. He wrote these things to his sons, who were going to be kings as well. And he is talking about the power that a king has and about all the different people that interact with him. And he's saying, look, people are going to have to be very careful in their interaction with you and have a great deal of wisdom, because if a king is angry about something, he has the power to do whatever he wants. But if he is favored toward these people, he is like the clouds that bring the spring rain, all this refreshment and all this blessing. And furthermore, the kings of Israel are also going to have to interact with other kings out there in the world. And he's saying, be careful how you deal with your authorities. Because whether they're right or wrong, they're still in charge and they have a lot of power. You think carefully, particularly when you're making an appeal to them, particularly when you're urging them to do something for you, to use their power on your behalf. Take a humble but a wise approach and use your head to figure out the kinds of ways that are most likely to be to your advantage in that situation. Rebellion and just in your face rejection of the authority, pushing back with violence, that is unlikely to help your cause. If you are really interested in getting the authority on your side, accept the position that they're in and look for the wisest way to go about it. And I think we see that principle reflected in the response of Esther. Or more broadly, what it goes on to say in Proverbs 16, the heart of the wise makes his speech judicious. Judicious, prudent, cautious, careful. You don't just say everything that is on your mind when you're dealing with an authority. You recognize the vulnerable position that you're in, and you find the most skillful and gracious way to communicate your point. The heart of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. I think that could go a long way to help us. If we pride ourselves on being people that speak our mind and are just totally transparent, that is not necessarily a virtue. Proverbs is all about measuring your speech. It's all about figuring out what is going to be, what actually needs to be said in this moment, and what's the best way to say it in order to accomplish what I want, particularly when you're dealing with those who are in authority or when you're in a vulnerable position. So don't just take risks, even if you're trying to do a good thing. Don't just take risks. Think about the most effective way to go about it. And so maybe the next time that you're having to make an appeal to an authority, maybe go back and read Esther 5, verses 1 to 8, and see if that doesn't get your mind going a certain direction. There really are some helpful lessons here. And you say, I don't know how I could have come up with that. Or in my situation, what would be the wise approach? Well, the Bible says in James 1:5, if you lack wisdom, ask from God. The point is, slow down. Don't be impulsive. Don't just barge in there. And if you don't know what to do, often the best way is to say as little as possible and just be crying out to God to give you wisdom in that situation. And by the way, this is not just an Old Testament kind of teaching. Listen to what Jesus says. Remember this in Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. He's talking about how the people of God, Jesus' disciples, are going to be persecuted. And you're going to be surrounded by a world that hates you, that hates your Christ, that hates your message. And how are you going to navigate that? He says, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. That is quite a nice edge of how you're supposed to deal with these situations. And that's going to look different in any particular circumstance. But both of these things together are what make it most likely, humanly speaking, that our purposes will be effective, to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. You say, what does that look like? Well, if you jump forward to one of Jesus' most famous disciples, the Apostle Paul. He was a man who was no stranger to persecution, and he suffered some just extreme forms of beatings and ultimately execution, and there were things that he just could not get out of, humanly speaking. And sometimes he just had to take it. And there was no way to appeal to his authorities. But there were plenty of times when he used his wisdom to figure out a way that would be most likely to get his goal accomplished. You realize that sometimes Paul actually ran away from his persecutors. He didn't always stand there and just let them beat him up. And there were other times when they were getting ready to beat him up, or they already had, and he said, do you guys realize that I'm a Roman citizen? And he's not in your face harsh about it, but he's saying, look, according to the laws of the empire, what you're about ready to do or what you've already done is illegal. And at times he stood up on the basis of his rights as a citizen, but he did it in a very careful way and only at certain times. There were a lot of judgment calls that this man is having to make as he navigates a world that hates him. And of course, he had opportunities to speak directly to kings, and he didn't mince any words when it came to the gospel and preaching to those men about their need of repentance and of Christ. And yet, at the same time, they understood that he was not a political revolutionary. And sometimes they're even looking for ways to let him go legitimately because they knew that he wasn't guilty of death. So in other words, he was able to have a positive personal relationship with the authorities, even when he had to be direct about the gospel and so forth. And so we see a lot of examples from his life. And one other passage, you might remember this from our study of Luke. Jesus is talking there about the use of money. Not so much about politics, but about money. He says, "For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings." And I'm not going to re-preach that whole sermon. That was a pretty challenging statement. This is Jesus' instruction for his disciples. But he's saying, you know, when you look out on the world and how people manage money and how people lead organizations that are all about making money, they are very wise about cutting costs, about where to make investments, about hiring people, about taking on certain responsibilities, about letting other things go, because they're putting everything through the filter of what's going to make me a profit. And he's saying you need to be thinking in terms of what is going to be the most eternally advantageous, given my resources, my relationships, my abilities, and my money. How can I most skillfully use this to accomplish worthwhile eternal things? Take a lesson from the world. Now, Jesus doesn't say that very often. But he says, take a lesson from the world as to working skillfully with your resources and opportunities to make sure that you're being as profitable as possible, spiritually speaking. And I think we see that general concept reflected in the story of Esther. And folks, this is so much more important in the environment that we find ourselves living today. When our nation is so polarized and Christianity is so misunderstood as a political party or political position, and because of that, we find ourselves marginalized, often not because of the gospel, but because we're so pushy and harsh and rude about our political positions. And when we come to somebody like Esther, what we're seeing is, even if you believe strongly about something, the answer probably isn't in going on Facebook and blasting everybody who doesn't agree with you. What is the way to make your case most judiciously? You're not going to persuade people by acting like an idiot. Seek the Lord. Seek wisdom. Learn from the examples of Scripture how it is that even while maintaining our convictions, we're able to be persuasive representatives of the Lord Jesus Christ in this world. There really is a shrewdness and a wisdom that we ought to pursue and that we ought to nurture. Now, as we come to the second part of the passage, I'm not going to spend as much time here, and it's like we're jumping to a totally different subject. We've been talking about Esther and her shrewdness, and now we're on to Haman, divine providence, and human pride. This is the arch enemy, the latest version of Agag, the enemy of God's people. And he is just dripping with the kind of pride that probably goes on in our hearts, but it's so often cloudy and undetected, but here it's just like it's shouting. It's like the author is putting out on display the sorts of things that often go on in our own hearts, but we are too proud to admit it. In these verses, Haman puts his egotism on full and ridiculous display. And it's another way in which the author is kind of mocking the ungodly, as he tells us about Haman. So let's read little by little these verses. In chapter 5, verse 9, "And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart." How would you have felt if you just came out of a party with the queen? "But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him. He was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Talk about a mood swing. And what was it that created the swing? The fact that he runs into Mordecai and Mordecai is totally indifferent to him. I mean, he not only doesn't bow before him, he doesn't even stand up to recognize him or tremble. Apparently he's seated there at the king's table. He didn't stand up to recognize this great pompous leader making his way through the court. And he has this violent swing of emotions from the heights of joy to this seething, almost exploding anger. But in verse 10, he backs off. He knows there's a bigger picture. He gets back onto himself, settles down. And then what's going to happen? Verse 10, nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Look at how great I am. Those verses are just dripping with the pompous talk about the wealth and the status that he had achieved. And now the icing on the cake, verse 12. Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. I'm just on top of the world. And so he adds to all of his accomplishments this gloating that twice now he had been invited to an exclusive event with Queen Esther. And yet Mordecai isn't totally out of the picture, as verse 13 goes on to say, yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. And you find this man is just obsessively preoccupied with this one person. He had everything the world had to offer in terms of money and position and pleasures. And there was one person that was not giving him the respect he thought he deserved. And that one person just ruined it all for him. It reminded me of that famous statement that John D. Rockefeller apparently said, that when somebody asked him how much money is enough, he said, just a little bit more. And Haman just wants a little bit more for Mordecai to recognize him. I like how Ian Duguid describes what's happening in this man. He says, Haman's emotional strings were being pulled by his idol, which was public respect. When that idol was fed, he felt good. But when his idol was challenged, it led him to malice and anger. The same malice that caused his earlier decree to eliminate the Jewish people. His joy and his anger were simply the outward expressions of his heart's idolatry. In other words, when he's getting respect and accolades and status, he's thrilled. When he is denied that by one person even, he's in the dumps and he's upset. What you find there is that somebody's emotions, particularly their strong emotions, are a window into their soul. And what we ought to learn from this is, as we consider our own lives and our own struggle with idolatry of whatever kind, probably the things that make me really happy and the things that make me really mad have an inordinate place in the affections of my heart. Strong emotions are a mirror that reflect back to us what we really care about. And it may not be Jesus. It may be some idol like Haman was displaying here. In fact, this commentator goes on to do a little thought experiment. He says, if you were sitting across the table from Haman and you had a little bit of time to be a counselor to him, what kinds of questions would you ask Haman? What Bible truths would you bring out to him? What verses, what principles would you challenge him with to try to get him to see what's going on? And not just to see what's going on, but what is the solution for this problem of his heart? It's an interesting question. Whenever you run across a negative example like this in Scripture, if you had the opportunity, whether it's an unregenerate person that's under discussion or a regenerate person, how would you counsel this individual? Put yourself in the shoes of the counselor. What would you be saying to him to help him see himself? All right? That's your project when you sit down for lunch today. Somebody asked the question, preferably the dads, what do you think we ought to say to Haman? What is the biblical approach to dealing with the very real struggle that Haman had, that frankly all of us have, about something or other? I think it'll be a useful exercise. Well, once again, a woman is introduced, in this case, kind of out of the blue. It's his wife. Her name is Zeresh, verse 14. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased, it was good to him, to Haman, and he had the gallows made. This woman proposes a solution that was as big as Haman's ego. 50 cubits is about 75 feet high. And from what we know about these archaeological discoveries, this would have been way up and above, bigger than anything in the city. Maybe it could get so big by being erected up on the side of a mountain or something. It's hard to imagine how even they could pull this off so quickly. But the point is, I got this problem that stands in the way of my huge ego. So she says, all right, you're going to find a huge way to just get rid of Mordecai and get the message out there. You're the winner here. Everybody's got to respect you. Nobody can stand in your way. And he falls for it, just like Xerxes had fallen for female arguments before. Once again, a woman takes the upper hand, and once again, mocking the decree about husbandly power in chapter 1. Who was the one who came up with the way to supposedly deal with this? It was a woman, and she is, by even Haman, at this point, considered, wow, you really saved me. What a great idea. This is going to help me so much. Again, to Proverbs, talking about Haman, when pride comes, then comes disgrace, but with the humble is wisdom. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And this guy is going to fall very fast when we come back to chapter 6. Well, let's package all that together. What have we seen this morning? I think we could capture the point this way. God sovereignly directs human choices, whether those choices be good or bad, to accomplish the outcomes that he intends. God sovereignly directs human choices, authentic human choices. In the end, they're going to be used to accomplish what he set out to do originally. And you can think back on that illustration of a chess game. I mean, these things are so hard to put together in our minds. This isn't the best way to talk about it, but it's like the chess game is going on two levels. And down here on the human level, these people are picking up chess pieces and moving them there to best accomplish what they think is going to get at their purpose. And God's not violating their will. They are doing what they want to do. Nevertheless, it's like God's hand is over here, and even as they're making these real choices, God is steering those same hands to the end that he has determined. Theologically, that's called compatibilism, where human beings, God gives them the opportunity to act in accordance with their nature and what they desire, what they want. And there is free will in the sense that people will do what's going on in their hearts. And we know that what's going on in the unregenerate heart is self, it's sin, it's rebellion. So you're going to do what you want to do. You're going to rebel against God. But somehow, through all of that, whether it's the choices of the unregenerate or the choices of God's people, in them he's working to will to do of his own pleasure, Philippians chapter 2, that process is being mysteriously guided by the hand of God to accomplish his decrees. Therefore, by way of application, take heart as you skillfully take risks for God. When you're in an Esther-like position and you think you've got a plan, use your head, pray for help. But at the end of the day, recognize God is the one that is orchestrating these events and be encouraged that he is going to accomplish his purposes. Frankly, even if you mess up, he's going to accomplish his purposes. And if you're a Haman type, you're really a fool. There is no way you're going to win against God. For all of your self-expression and self-assertion, and I'm the big shot, and I'm going to get what I want, God is going to order all things, even your rebellious choices, to contribute to his plan, and he's going to do what he is going to do. And so, if you use your head, just recognize the best thing for you is to humble yourself, turn from your sin, and collapse in the arms of this God who has so graciously provided for you in Christ, because he is going to do what he's going to do. You cannot successfully fight against the Lord. Protection, security, joy is only in surrender and reliance upon this God of sovereignty.